for coming, and thanks for having me. This is my third year at Tech Days, and it's always great to come back to Belgium. I love the venues they get here. It's really nice to kind of present in this kind of theater format. So I hope you're enjoying yourselves, and I hope you're having a nice Valentine's Day. Kind of weird to be at a technical conference on a Valentine's Day, but I'm doing what I love, which is talking about application lifecycle management in Visual Studio 11. Just in case she watches the recording, I love my girlfriend too. She's back in Seattle right now. She's actually getting ready to present to Bill and Melinda Gates today, which is kind of a stressful thing to do on a Valentine's Day, but hey, whatever. So this is all about the new capabilities around application lifecycle management that are coming in Visual Studio 11. So I've got a lot to show you. We're not going to spend a lot of time on kind of existing functionality, but I promise you, even if you're not using our ALM tooling today, I think you'll still see a lot of stuff in here that you can look forward to picking up right away. Show of hands, how many people are using Team Foundation Server today? Oh, fantastic. I love you guys. Awesome. If you're not, let's talk after this. But certainly, let's give you some things to think about here. So if you if you're interested after this session, I always present this slide first because I tend to forget it if I don't. All of my demos, my virtual machine, hands-on labs, everything is available on my blog, which is blogs.msdn.com/BrianKEL. And then this is just a quick, short hyperlink to take you straight to the Visual Studio 11 virtual machine and hands-on lab. So everything I'm showing you here is based on the developer preview that we released back in September. I was really hoping I'd be able to do this session on the beta, which is coming up really soon, but unfortunately I didn't get the clearance for that. So this is probably the last week I'll be showing you the developer preview. I do have a small portion of the beta that I'm going to show you if you guys promise not to get me in trouble. We are looking forward to releasing the beta very, very soon. We have not yet released a date for the beta, but you probably saw that Windows 8 is coming out on February 28th, the beta for Windows 8. So I'll let you kind of connect the dots and draw your own conclusions about when Visual Studio is coming. So this is the slide that I usually use to talk about everything that we're doing across application lifecycle management. And this is kind of what we're going to ground ourselves on during this session. Because as you think about application lifecycle management, there's actually a lot of things that go on here and a lot of interesting problems that we think we can solve with some better tooling and process to really, at the end of the day, help you come together as a team and build great, high-quality software faster. So that's our mission. And so if we start kind of in the upper left quadrant here and we think about some of the problems that you may be seeing today in software development, certainly I see it in a lot of the customers I work with, one of the problems you have is misunderstood requirements. You know, we have this saying at Microsoft, how often have you built what your customer asked for, but not really what your customer wanted? And so that's kind of a challenge that we're trying to solve. I'm just going to set up a few more of these problems, and then I'll jump straight into the solution. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time in PowerPoint today. The other one is conflicting priorities. You know, you've got different evolving landscapes of where your opportunities and your challenges are going to lie for the software that you're putting together. And so how do you respond and react and reprioritize those based on what your customers want? Another thing is you kind of go around here once you've defined and figured out what it is you're going to build. One of the big problems that we see all the time is that teams are in the middle of a sprint and they keep losing focus. You know, I've seen data that shows that as software developers, oftentimes we're interrupted as often as every 5 minutes. And whether that's an email coming in or your boss walking into your office or you know, any number of things that could be happening during the course of the day, we want to really help you as developers get back into the zone and make sure that we remove any problems with the tooling or problems with being able to go in and out of that context. And I've got some really nice things that we've done in that area that I think you'll enjoy. And then unmet user expectations. So, you know, we talked to the users 6 weeks ago at the beginning of the sprint, and we built what we thought they wanted, and then we kind of threw it over the wall to them. Well, chances are it's probably not going to be exactly what they had in mind. So how do we get that feedback back into the product team and make sure that the next iteration or in the time we have remaining on this particular iteration, we can make sure to get it right? And then, you know, as software developers, we kind of ship the code over to the ops team and our job is done, right? We can go home and rest easy over the weekend. Obviously, that's kind of a dream world. We know that there's going to be issues in production oftentimes, and oftentimes we get a call from our friends that are in some of these IT sessions, and they say, hey, your application code's not working. And we say, all right, can you get a little bit more specific than that? And they say, well, it's, you know, got this yellow screen that keeps popping up, the famous ASP.NET yellow screen of death or whatever. Okay, well, you know, every time we had these in the past, we know that we need an event log and we need to know what system this is running on and what the system resources are and yada, yada, yada. And so you go back and forth and you have this ping pong problem of trying to get that diagnostic from the development operations team. And then once you do, then how do you actually start to debug and step through that in Visual Studio? Well, we've done some interesting things in that space as well, which I'll show you. So that's a set of problems. I'm sure everyone in this room can relate to at least a couple of these. What are we going to do about this? Well, the first thing I'm going to talk about is the definition stage. And so one of the things that we've done is we've introduced a new tool within the Visual Studio 11 family that is based on PowerPoint that allows you to work with storyboards. And I'm going to show you that momentarily. And then during the storyboarding process, that's a really great time to get crystal clear about what it is that your users expect your code to do. And then after you go out and build something and throw it over the wall to the users, we want to be able to get that feedback back in. And that's where we have a feedback tool that's built specifically for stakeholders. Those could be end users. It could be your legal team who needs to review and make sure that the privacy policy is serviced on all the appropriate pages. Anybody who's a stakeholder can then use this tool and then capture data in a really rich way. So enough PowerPoint for now. Actually, ironically, I'm going to show you PowerPoint, but in a different context. Here. So what I have here is the developer preview virtual machine. And this is a storyboard that I created using the new PowerPoint add-on. And so here you can see this looks, you know, pretty much like a Windows Forms, or sorry, a web application. Of course, you could create a Windows Forms application or a Windows 8 application, and you can really model anything that you may be used to, mobile application. You see I've created a phone application in here. I have a number of animations. And this is a really great tool that you can either pull in a bunch of stakeholders into a room and show it on a projector, or if you're lucky, a theater screen. And then you can start talking through the user interface and talk about the interactions and whether or not they like the color of this button and the way that this page flows to the next page. Or oftentimes, we don't always have the luxury of sitting side by side with our users or our future users. And so since this is in PowerPoint, I can just put it on a SharePoint site or email it to my stakeholders. They can leave comments, send that back to us. So there's just a really lot of nice ways that you can use this. So to create a new page in here, it's just a matter of coming in here and saying new slide. As it turns out, PowerPoint actually really lends itself to the ability to create storyboards well, because they have this idea of master pages, kind of like ASP.NET, so they have these master layouts. And so we ship a layout, for example, that gives you SharePoint. And so if I want to create a SharePoint site, I can come in here and, you know, do things like customize the URL. And then maybe I'm actually not building a SharePoint site. Maybe I'm building my Fabricam Fiber website. Well, sometimes you're not actually building a complete greenfield storyboard. You need to bring in some existing assets from a site that you already have. And so one of the things that we allow you to easily do is come in here and take a screenshot. Let me just make sure my page is loaded here. So we can take some of those UI elements quickly over and say, grab a screen clipping. And drop that into place. And then over here on the right-hand side, we've got a ton of shapes. So we have, you know, a button that we can grab, create new, and I won't take the time to do it, but if I wanted to set the exact font size and kerning and color and, you know, whatever my corporate website design standards are, I could take the time to do that. And then once you've created that and styled that exactly how you'd like, one of the things you may want to do is then store this in your shape library so that you can use it later. So I can say add to my shapes and then call this a Fabricam button. And then if I want to use that again, I can just drag it back out. And we also let you share these shapes as well, so I can export all these shapes and then import other people on my team's shapes. We're going to be building a really nice community website around this as well, so we can have other people. If you want to contribute your own shapes to this library, you can do that. We'll have a power tool that helps you actually build some really complex, rich shapes. So, for example, if you go into the calendar control, for example, this isn't just a bitmap that you can, you know, resize like an image. It actually is, you know, modeled by all these individual grids. And so if I wanted to change this to April, I could do that. If I wanted to change the current date, I could do that. So really whatever your storyboard requires. And then finally, let's take a pointer and drop that on there. We'll go to animations. Just typical PowerPoint stuff, all the things we learned in university. And there we go. So, you know, it's really, really basic, and it's meant to be basic. You know, it's not something that you have to be a rocket scientist at PowerPoint to be able to use. You can be a business analyst. You can be, you know, anybody that really knows PowerPoint can jump right in here and start creating storyboards. I think this entire storyboard that I have here, I created about 15 minutes. And the other nice thing about this is I have a lot of people ask, well, we still have the Blend Sketchflow product, if anybody's used Sketchflow. And I see a lot of people that use tools like Visio to create storyboards. And if you're like using those tools, that's great. But if I was to ask everybody in here how many people, you know, are really good at expression or how many people could do something like this in Visio, we probably just see a handful of people. Whereas if I asked how many people have PowerPoint, we find that virtually everybody that's a stakeholder within an organization has some flavor of PowerPoint. So that's why we're excited about this, is really bringing storyboarding to the masses. So we've kind of built our application, or we've built our storyboard, and we go off and we build some software. The next thing I'm going to show you is actually out of our beta. And this is what the beta dashboards look like when you get the beta very soon here. And so as a business analyst or as a product owner, the next thing I may want to do is say, let me get some feedback from some of my stakeholders about the application we just delivered. And so what you can do is say, request feedback. And then here I can type the name of a person that I want to get feedback from. And I can say, you know, is this a web application, or how do you install this application? If it's not a web app, we'll just keep it simple. So, Fabricam. And then down here, we're actually guiding them along the way of exactly what we want feedback on. Because as a product owner, we know more than the end user does about what's ready and what we'd like feedback on. You know, we maybe aren't done with the entire implementation, but we know that there are certain elements of this that the team just finished, and we really want to get some feedback on. So we can say something like, you know, does the UI look finished? And then we can give feedback, you know, is all of the text positioned properly, et cetera. And then we can say another feedback item, you know, is this going to work for our support team, et cetera. And then once I say send this, it's going to generate an email that I can then share with Julie, and then she can open up the feedback tool and then start going through the process of sending us that feedback. And so I've actually already generated one of these emails. And so if I open that email, you'll see she's being prompted to install the feedback tool if she doesn't already have that. And so that's going to be something that's just a few minute installation that she does one time. And then once she's done with that, then she can say, start this feedback session. And it's going to launch this feedback tool along with all the parameters that I just fed into it when I requested her feedback. So here you can see along the left-hand side, this is actually very similar to the Microsoft Test Runner. If you've seen Microsoft Test Runner in 2010, it basically guides us along the way. So it says, hey, we need to open up this application. And then once you're ready with this application, then we can say next. And then it's prompting me basically to say, does the UI look ready? Well, the other really cool thing about this is that we can be capturing video recording. We can be capturing voice narratives. So if your user is sitting there, you know, yelling and cursing at your application because they just hate it, we can now capture that and store it in the Team Foundation server. How actionable is that? So that's really, really cool. I can look at this and say, you know, I don't really like this guy down here. And I can grab a screenshot of this guy. He doesn't even work for us anymore. So, you know, I'm not really happy with the UI. Let me check out the next piece of feedback. Does the Solution Center provide enough functionality for all of our users to self-serve effectively? And, you know, this looks pretty good, but, actually that clearly doesn't provide enough functionality. So I can grab a screenshot here and, you know, I hope this isn't our production server. And so again, just making it really easy, and then I can submit and I can save this feedback. It's automatically going to push that back to Team Foundation server for me. And then as a product owner, if I go back to Team Web Access now, I can see down here that I have some additional feedback that's come back from my users. And so if I look at this feedback, I can say, here's a response from Annie about this particular thing we asked for her feedback on. And because we're using Team Foundation Server, we get that full end-to-end traceability across everything in the lifecycle. So if I start with my requirement, for example, I can say, this is ready for some feedback. Let me request feedback from these 10 users on this particular requirement. Wait a day or two, go back and see, is that requirement actually living up to user expectations? And that's really nice, especially if you're in an environment where you need to ensure compliance. You need to make sure that, you know, X number of stakeholders actually sign off on the UI before you go to the next milestone. So I think this has a lot of really great implications. Number one, for clients, compliance. Number two, when you just can't be in the room with your users and watch them use the application, this is kind of the next best thing. The other really cool thing that I've noticed back at Microsoft is we've been using tools like this that capture video recordings, and sometimes you can file bugs this way that you just can't describe any other way. So this tester, this is a true story, this tester was working with Visual Studio, and this is an early build of Visual Studio 11, and he grabs one of the windows, and I don't know why he decided to do this, but he decided to take his mouse and just drag it back and forth really fast across the screen, and it crashed Visual Studio. So how do you say that in a bug? How do you say, yeah, if I drag it, you know, 6 times per minute back and forth? Well, with a video, you can actually capture that, and then the developer who owns that can look at that and say, yeah, sure enough, that's, you know, drag it really fast and it actually breaks it. So it's just that kind of picture is worth a thousand words kind of thing, where if we start modeling things with storyboards, we like to say that a storyboard is worth a 1,000-page spec. And then once again, as you're starting to give feedback, kind of that feedback, that rich feedback you log, can be worth, you know, its weight in gold in terms of really trying to understand exactly how the user was using your software when they encountered a bug or when they found something that they didn't like. Okay? So that's the beta, our little secret. Don't tell anyone. So that's kind of the definition phase, and there's a lot of stuff that we've had in Team Foundation Server for a while. You know, I mentioned the ability to capture all of your user stories and your requirements and kind of enable that end-to-end traceability. So a lot of those things are in the product today. These are some of the additional things we're doing both in the requirements management and in the feedback collection space to make your lives a little easier here. So then moving right along to the next quadrant here, probably most people in this room, how many people are software developers, write code most of the day? Okay, I imagine some of the rest of you are, just out of curiosity, how many are business analysts, kind of define or product owner role? Okay, a few of you, how many are testers? Testers? Okay, if you know any testers, tell them to come to my session tomorrow. We'll be talking about software testing. Actually, tomorrow's session is focused on software testing from both the manual and the test automation side. So I think there's something there for everyone. I'll be focusing on not only manual testing, but also what's new for coded UI tests, what's new for lab management. I'll show you how much easier it is to quickly set up a lab management rig without requiring SCVMM or Hyper-V or anything special along those lines. But as software developers, you know, I mentioned that we're often getting interrupted frequently. And so what can we do to help manage those tasks, to help you really iteratively plan those projects and manage your capacity and avoid those interruptions, or at least handle those interruptions gracefully when they do happen? And then there's a whole bunch of other things we've done to make your lives as developers better that don't squarely fit within application lifecycle management per se, but I think you're going to really enjoy them. So let me jump right back into the developer preview here. So the first thing that I'll focus on is the new Agile planning tools that we have. And so we've actually baked all the Agile planning tools right into the Team Foundation Server web access, which is now built into the product. So when you install Team Foundation Server 11, you're going to get web access right in the product. And one of the things that we've added to Team Foundation Server is the concept of a team. Go figure. You know, at Microsoft, we have maybe 1,000 or 2,000 people that are using each one of our Team Foundation Server instances, and that's great. We scale really, really well for a Team Foundation Server, but we don't every day work with, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 people. We usually work with a handful of people. At Microsoft, we call them a feature team. You may have, you know, a scrum team or any number of different teams that you have that you work with. You may work with two or three different teams, but we want to really give teams the ability to have their own identity within Team Foundation Server. And so you'll notice here that I have my Fabricam Fiber web team. It consists of these four individuals. And then each team gets to manage their own backlog if you want. They can manage their own iterations. And so if I look at my backlog, you'll notice here that I have a list of all of the things that my team is currently tracking against the product that we may want to enable in the future. Now, I should stop right here and say that a few of the terms that I'm using today come directly out of Scrum. So how many people are practicing Scrum or some flavor of Scrum? Okay, that's great. If you're using Scrum already, I think you're going to love these tools. But if you're not using Scrum, I don't want to scare you, because these tools can certainly be used regardless of the process that you're using. Whenever I talk to a customer, almost every single customer that's of any, you know, kind of complexity in terms of team members or complex projects or needing to live up to certain compliance regulations, almost all of those customers that I talk to, they customize the Team Foundation Server process template in some way or another. They add a few fields, they add a few workflows, and these tools are meant to be flexible so that you can use them regardless of the template that you're using here. So whether it's CMMI or Scrum or anything in between, we want to help you with that. So I happen to be using Scrum here, and with my product backlog, I can say things like, you know, make sure Brian gets a cup of coffee in the morning. And I can just press enter at that point. And it's just going to add that straight to my backlog. That's getting stored directly in Team Foundation Server. You know, we can move things around and reorder this backlog and reprioritize it, which if you've tried doing this in TFS 2010, it can be kind of a pain, because you would have to go in here and say, well, if I want to move 4 to 3, I have to, you know, replace the priority of 3 with 4 and replace the priority of 4 with 3. And, you know, it's just, it'll make you go crazy. But here I can just quickly drag and drop things around here. I can say that this is something that's really important. I want to make sure that we do it in the current sprint. So I can assign it to that sprint. And notice over here that it's assigned to Sprint 3. The other thing that's nice about this is that when I'm just quickly capturing ideas for my backlog, I don't have to give a ton of definition for that particular user story. And so here I can continue later on and flesh this out and say, what's the effort? You know, who is this assigned to? And then approve that into my sprint. But I'm not required to right out of the gate. The other thing that we can do here is we can take a look at the velocity indicators. So velocity shows you historically how many story points or hours or t-shirt sizes, whatever units you want to use for your team, were you able to complete in previous iterations. And that can help you ballpark how much of the work you want to take on for the current and future iterations. So now if we drop into the individual Sprint 3, one of the things that we can do is we can start to break down this work. So currently we have a high-level user story or a requirement, and we want to break this down into the individual tasks that are going to be required to implement that. So, you know, maybe we need to brew a cup of coffee. We'll assign that to Annie. And then, I don't know, clean the coffee cups. And so there I've taken that work and I've quickly broken it down into the implementation details. And notice what happened right away is my team is now red. So I'm over capacity for Cameron and Annie. And this happens all the time, right? You know, you get some additional requirements or you are looking at an additional requirement and you find that there's additional work that maybe you didn't realize when you first started fleshing this out. And now you need to go install, you know, a new database or something like that in order to make this particular requirement implemented. And so as you're going through that, maybe in your daily stand-up meetings or whenever you get together as a team, you can always come to this page and make adjustments to make sure that you're in line with the expectations to hit what you're expected to deliver at the end of that milestone. And so one of the ways I may mitigate this is I could say, okay, here's some work that hasn't yet been started. And so I can just drag and drop that to some future sprint. And then this updates right away. The other nice thing about this is I see my burn down chart up here, and the burn down chart is updated in real time as well. So if you use Team Foundation Server today, you know we have a lot of really great reports that ship with TFS, and we're going to continue to ship those reports with TFS 11, but you also know that those reports are not quite real time. You have to wait for SQL Server reporting services to update in the background. Well, this is real time, so anytime you make a change, it's going to be instantly reflected in the velocity and the burn down charts. And finally, once we've decided, okay, we're happy with this plan, we can all go back to our desks and we can start working on something, then you can switch over to a task board. And a task board is probably not unlike what you may have in your existing rooms today, where you have a whiteboard and you have post-it notes that you move from left to right as you finish work. Well, this is the electronic version of this, which, of course, makes it really easy for you to work with extended teams. And so as I start to take work and drag and drop this over, we can start to close out user stories that are finished. I can come in here and, you know, say I've actually earned 3 hours against this. And as I'm making those adjustments, again, the burn down is updating in real time, and that looks pretty good. So I'm happy that we're going to hit our requirements by the end of this milestone. There's some other nice things in here too, like I can say, just show me all of my work. And that's nice when you get together with your team and say, here's what I'm working on right now, here's what I finished yesterday, here's my impediments. Or the other nice thing that you can do here is switch to a team members view. And so here across the left-hand side, I have all of my different team members, and then I can see at a glance who's working on what. So, you know, maybe Cameron, I know he's going to be out of the office tomorrow, so I'm going to take some of his work, and actually that works in the beta, but right now it doesn't work in the developer preview. I could drag and drop that onto myself, and that would change the requirement, okay? So that's enough agile planning. Let's actually get into Visual Studio and do something a little bit more interesting. So here, you know, I'm kind of in the middle of editing a bunch of files. I've set a few breakpoints. You know, if I had multiple monitors, then maybe I have some tool windows across multiple monitors. And my manager comes in and says, you know, I need you to stop everything and work on this bug or whatever, right? That happens to us all the time, right? And so one of the things that we can do now is if I go to Team Explorer, we've completely reimagined Team Explorer to kind of steal from the Windows team. And I now have this concept of my work. And under my work, you see a few options. Number one, I get to see at a glance all of the work items that are currently assigned to me for this given iteration. The other thing that I can do is I can come in here and say suspend. And when I suspend, got interrupted for bug fix again. When I suspend, it's going to take all of my edits, it's going to back those up onto Team Foundation Server, and it's also going to make note of all of my breakpoints, all of my open tabs, all of my windows across multiple monitors in my office. And then when I'm ready to come back to this, all I need to do is say resume, and it's automatically going to rehydrate all of that. And so if I just kind of close out of here, and I go along, I do something else, then I come back to my work, and if I see that I have some work that's suspended, I can say, go ahead and resume this work, and then it's going to take those changes and push them right back on my workspace. Okay? Right back to where you're at. Another thing that those of you that use TFS already will appreciate is that we can now search for work items right within Visual Studio. And so we can say, I know that there's this bug, something having to do with Canadian addresses, so I can search for that. And so here's a bug that I know that Julia is not going to be able to work on because she's enjoying her Valentine's Day. And so we'll go ahead and assign that to myself. And then if I go back to my work, then that shows up. Let me go ahead and check in that existing work. There we go. There's the bug. So I can say, I want to work on this. So we'll add this to in progress. And then we can start working on whatever it is that that this bug has to do. So with this particular bug, I know it's something to do with zip codes and postal codes and Canadian addresses. So if we open up this models file in here, we have an address. And I love it when my bugs are actually already fixed if I just uncomment something. So that's really nice. And this is kind of a complicated regular expression. I'd really like to have someone else on my team take a look at these changes. And now what we've done is we've built code review right into Visual Studio and Team Foundation Server. And so what I can do is say request review, and I want Cameron to take a look at this. And I can say, you know, can you make sure this zip code regex looks right? And I can say submit request. It's going to then save my changes and back those up as a change or as a shelf set on Team Foundation Server that Cameron now has access to. And now when Cameron drops into his Visual Studio and he takes a look at his work, then he'll notice that he has this code review request. And this is really nice because I've seen other code review requests that just maybe shoot an email or send a toast, and you can enable all those things if you want to, but maybe I don't want to be interrupted all the time every time, you know, Brian needs to have, you know, me look at his code. And so here, when it's just part of my work, then that can become the single dashboard that he goes to when he's finished with one set of contacts and he's ready for another. So here I can open up this code or open up this code review, and I can accept this. I can take a look at this particular file, and one of the things we've done is we've finally improved the diffing tool that's built into Visual Studio 11, and so now I can do something like, say, side by side, and it's really easy for me to see the differences between the two of these. The other nice thing, if you haven't had a chance to play with Visual Studio 11 yet, is that we have these new provisional tabs in the upper right-hand corner. So how often have you been in the middle of a debugging session and you step through, you step over, you step through, you step over, and then all of a sudden you've got like 40 different tabs open on Visual Studio. You need to go like buy a bigger monitor just to house everything, and then you're, you know, Shift F4 or whatever the thing is to close everything. Well, now when we're in the middle of doing debugging sessions or things that that may only temporarily require a source file to be open, like a code review, then by default we're going to put it into a provisional tab. And if I decide that I want to work with this permanently, I can say promote this, and then this will stay resident within my tab well. But by default, it's actually going to close once I'm done with this code review. So that's really, really nice. Something I use all the time. And whenever I have to go back to Visual Studio 2010 now, I definitely miss that. So Cameron can come in here and he can say, you know, this file looks pretty good. I like the regex. But maybe he says, you know, zip code, that's kind of a US only thing. So we should use postal code, something like that. And so he can say finish, and then he's back, and he's back to working on whatever he was working on. So now, as Brian, I then switch over. Remember, I could enable alerts if I wanted to, but I don't really want to be interrupted all the time. So the next time I go back to look at my work, then I notice that I have this code review that came back from Cameron, and I can take a look at his comments and say, he says, you know, I like the regex. We should use postal code. Well, that's cool. We'll you know, queue that up for a future bug, and then we can go into pending changes and go ahead and check that in. Okay. The other thing, while we're on pending changes, is if you've ever had to use Team Foundation Server and work offline, or if you wanted to go into another program like Emacs or your favorite editor to go work with another file, it can really be kind of a pain to have to go in and check out the files you want to edit because otherwise they're marked read-only on disk. It can be a real challenge there. And so one of the things that we've done in Team Foundation Server 11 is we've introduced this concept of local workspaces. And with local workspaces, one of the really nice things I can do is just come in here and just start working on the file system if I want to. So I can come in here and create a new text document. I can edit something with Notepad if I want to and make a quick change, something like that. And then what's happening in the background is that Visual Studio is actually keeping track of all those changes. And so here you can see that we've made a change to this alert.cs file. We've actually detected a change over here because there's a new file that showed up. By default, we actually don't include those new files into version control or into your pending changes because we want to avoid a scenario where you accidentally get a file on disk, like those thumbs.db files that sometimes show up in Windows. And so we make that an explicit operation. But if I come in here and say, yes, actually, I did want this new text document, I can go ahead and promote that. That's now included as part of my pending changes. And then I can go ahead and check in. So that's really, really nice. This is also supported with Team Explorer Everywhere as well. So one of the things that I'm hearing more and more from people is that maybe they're using a tool like Xcode to do iOS development. And Xcode only supports Subversion and Git out of the box. We would love to build a provider that plugs right into Xcode, but unfortunately Apple doesn't open up those extensibility models for us. So one of the things you can do now is you can use a tool like Xcode, you can make all your changes on disk, and then occasionally you can pop over to Team Explorer Everywhere, which is our TFS client built into Eclipse. And then from there, you can say, okay, here's all the changes I just made in the last 10 minutes. Let me go ahead and check those in. So really, we are truly being able to address any development environment now, regardless of whether or not they have built-in integration for TFS. The other thing I want to show you is what we've done in unit testing. So I sometimes ask how many people are writing unit tests, and I don't want to embarrass anybody. I don't write as many unit tests as I should, unfortunately. But one of the things that we did find when we talked to people that are using unit tests is, you may talk to a team of developers, and some of them like using InUnit. Some of them like using XUnit. Some of them like using the native MS test capabilities we shipped in Visual Studio 2005 and ever since then. And, that's great. We want to allow people to use their own sets of unit tests, but Visual Studio doesn't really have native integration for InUnit and XUnit. Well, now what we've done is we've actually shifted the unit testing model over to an extensible framework. And so we're working with third parties, like the guys behind InUnit and XUnit, so that they can actually ship adapters that plug right into Visual Studio. They can plug right into your build server so that you can start working with everything straight from within Visual Studio, and you really don't even have to care what those underlying unit tests are written in. So now if I build my project again, what it's going to do is take all the adapters I have installed on my system. Right now I have the built-in MS test adapter as well as the InUnit adapter on this machine. And it's going to look across all those tests to see what actually matches what it's understanding from that from those types of test formats. And so here if I double-click on this one, for example, this is just a classic MS test. And then if I go to, a couple of them in here, let me just run all these tests. I know I've got some InUnit ones in here as well. I think this one that fails. Yeah, this is an InUnit test. And so here we have the built-in mocking framework that shipped with newer versions of InUnit. And here you can see that I have a test that's failing. One of the things we've also done is we've improved the results that you get back from unit tests. And so here I can see the stack trace. I can see the exceptions that are being thrown both in my application code and in my test code as well. So we'll have support for XUnit, InUnit from our partners. We have MS test support. For any of you that are C++ developers, we now allow you to write unit tests for your C++ code. You can write those unit tests in C++, in Manage C++. You can write tests in C# that then call into C++. So all of those are really going to be available. And I've also seen some people start to extend and build their own testing frameworks as well. So if you have your own, you know, testing framework that you like, it's actually fairly simple to build your own adapter and make that available and ship it out to the community. So I'm betting that within a few months of Visual Studio 11 being released, we're going to see, you know, dozens of these start to show up. The other thing that that is kind of some rocket science work that we have coming out of Microsoft Research is known as Code Clone. And Code Clone is really cool. Let me go ahead and run Code Clone across my solution. What this is going to do is it's going to look across my entire solution for any code that is semantically similar. Notice I didn't say syntactically identical or anything like that, but semantically similar. And so what that means is that this actually has a strong understanding of the types and the variables that are used within my projects so that we can find places where somebody maybe took one section of code and said, yeah, that's kind of what I need, and let me just copy and paste it over here and change a couple lines. And, you know, that's great that they were able to do their job quickly, but we really should have taken the opportunity to refactor that into something that can be then commonly called from multiple places in my solution. So here, if I kind of flip back and forth, those of you in the front row may notice that this code is actually identical. The only difference down here is the redirect. So that's a great opportunity for refactoring, where we can create a common method and say, hey, you know, let's just pass in the redirect page as a string or something like that to the method. The other thing this is nice for is, let's say that I find a bug somewhere in my code. I don't write bugs, but occasionally other people do, right? And so I find bugs, and I go in and I fix them, and I say, where else do I need to go fix this bug? And so this is a really great tool for saying, okay, let me find some sections of code that look very similar, semantically similar to what I have here. The other kind of other example here is, let's say that I'm a junior developer and I'm coming in here, or not even necessarily a junior developer, I'm looking at someone else's code and I'm trying to figure out how to use a particular object. And I know that I need to new up that object, and then maybe I need to make an update to it. Well, let me go ahead and write those lines, and then what you can do is say, you know, show me anything else that kind of matches that. And so you can right-click and say, find matching clones in solution. I actually haven't tried those particular lines, but we'll see what it comes back with. And yeah, that one's not as interesting. But if I found one in here, like, you know, show me every time that I'm doing an insert or update, this should probably come back with something. So there's an exact match. Let's see. Give me 1 second. I know I've got some better examples in here. Well, I don't want to debug this on the fly. It's been a while since I've searched this particular solution for code clones. But the idea is that by default, when you say analyze search for code clones, it's looking for rather large blocks of code. We don't want to tell you, hey, you newed up a string over here, and you newed up a string over here, and that's probably a clone. That wouldn't be very interesting. That's very noisy. However, you can say these three lines of code are very interesting to me. I just found a bug in there or something like that. And you can just highlight and say right-click, find clones, and then we'll look across your entire solution for that level of granularity. And it doesn't matter if you're using the same objects or not. If we find similar objects, maybe similar objects that have inherited from other common base objects, there's actually a lot of really good detection algorithms that are going on behind the scenes to help you find that. So that's Code Clone, unit testing, some of our agile planning tools, and we'll get back to some questions as well. So let me get through kind of this last section, which is operations. So I mentioned earlier the problem of, you know, you take your code and you throw it over to the operations team and they find some sort of issue and you're going back and forth and you know, we can kind of make fun of that whole situation, but it really is a problem that people waste a lot of time on, and all that time wasted is time that you still have an issue that's running on your production server, and it can become very difficult to actually diagnose what's going on. And so there's two major things we're doing in this release to really help with that. And the first is that we've reached over to our friends in the System Center group, and the guys that write System Center Operations Manager have written a plugin that can then talk to Team Foundation Server That's actually something that you'll be able to use with System Center 2012 and TFS 2010 or TFS 11. And the idea is that they're monitoring, you know, 20 or 30,000 servers running in production, and occasionally they see servers that are starting to have issues that are showing up. And so they can take a look at those issues and they could say, okay, this is either a config problem or a hardware problem that we can fix ourselves, or it's some sort of problem within the application code. And if they can determine that it's a problem in the application code, they need to get some developers involved to take a look at what's going on. And a few years ago, we acquired a company called AviCode, and AviCode is an always-on monitoring solution. So you put it on your server, and it's continuing to collect information about exactly what's happening at a stack trace level across your .NET or your C++ code. And then what you can now do is you can run AviCode right within your System Center Operations Manager instances as well. And so going back to the operations person who finds an incident, what they can do now is they can right-click on that issue, and they can say, create a bug over in Team Foundation Server, and then they're done. They've passed the problem over to the application support team, so you guys, and when you open that bug within TFS, you'll now see all the AviCode information as well as any other information that the ops team has decided to attach to that issue. So that could be an event log, it could be a security log, any number of things, special logging files that you decide are important for your application, and then you have everything at your fingertips that you need to diagnose that issue. Now, that's great if you're running System Center Operations Manager, and I would certainly encourage you to do that, but obviously that's not right in all situations. Sometimes you ship code to your end-user customers, or sometimes you just don't have System Center deployed. And so we have another process that allows you to do something very similar, which is building upon the IntelliTrace capability that we shipped with Visual Studio 2010. How many people have used IntelliTrace in 2010? That's not enough. Okay, I'd like to see some more hands next year. So IntelliTrace can be your best friend, because on your managed applications, anything that's running on .NET, it can basically run in the background and say, okay, what is my application doing? We accessed this registry key, and we pulled this value, and we passed it over to this method, and this method returned this value. Then we tried writing to this file, but we didn't have access to the disk, so it threw an exception, and we caught this exception. And I'll show you a quick example of how IntelliTrace can work. Well, in 2010, it was only available to be run in either your development or your test environments. As a developer, I could press F5 and I can kind of step through the code and see historically and go back in time and see exactly how this value derived from this value way up here. The other thing I could do is I could have my testers running it as part of their manual tests or their automated tests, so that when they found an issue, they could attach that IntelliTrace file and I could open that up within Visual Studio. So now, finally, one step forward, let me switch back to my demo machine and I'll show you what we've done to enable you to use this on any production system. So what we've done is we've actually created a PowerShell set of commands that are based on IntelliTrace. And so you can imagine that this will ship as just a cab file that you can then expand. You can download it from Microsoft.com. We'll ship it with Visual Studio, so you could put it on a memory stick, or you could copy it across the network if you have access to your production data centers. A lot of the time, you can't get access to those production data centers over the network. And so one option is to put this on a memory stick, walk up to that production server, and say, let me start collecting that PowerShell data. Well, a few minutes ago, we actually saw that my production system is having some server outages, some exceptions that are throwing when we take a look at particular customer records. And so this is something that I would like to diagnose and try to understand from an IntelliTrace perspective so that we can fix this issue. And so if I drop back into PowerShell here, then I can say import module, and then I just need to point it to the PowerShell DLL. And so if you haven't used PowerShell before, you know, this is not rocket science. There's just a few commands you need to run. And so now what I'm saying is, show me all the commands that have something to do with IntelliTrace. And so here you can see I have a few commands. One is I can start collecting IntelliTrace information, and then once I'm done with that, I have a couple of options. I can either checkpoint that data, or I can stop the entire collection of the data. And so there's an important thing to point out here. IntelliTrace is, you know, has Spinal Tap say. It really goes up to 11. It's a very intensive collection operation that captures everything that's running in your code, that's running in the core .NET framework code, accesses to the registry, to the file system, any exceptions that are thrown and caught. And you can quickly gather a lot of data. It is not an always-on monitoring solution. In the future, that's where we'd like to take it. But right now, the idea is I found an issue that's running in production, and now what I want to do is turn on that data capture so that I can grab the information that I think I need and get that over to the development team as quickly as possible. So I'm going to say start IntelliTrace collection. I'm going to pass in the name of my app pool. I'm going to give it the location of where I want to store that IntelliTrace information. And then finally, I'm going to pass in what's called a collection plan. Collection plan basically says, how much data do I want to collect, verbose, basic, which modules am I interested in monitoring? And then when I do that, what it does is it actually recycles that app pool, so that's something to be aware of, but it's recycling that app pool, and then it's going to actually rewrite all the MSIL for this .NET application so that we can automatically capture all that information as your application is executing. So now if I rebuild this application, it's going to JIT it, it's going to rewrite that MSIL, and then we go in there, and that's how we capture all the information that says exactly what your application is doing. Which gives me a nice chance to have a drink of water. Okay, there we go. Usually it's a little faster than that. And so what I can do at this point is I can basically just reproduce the issue. And so there, I've reproduced the issue. Now if I drop back to PowerShell, again, I have that option to either checkpoint that collection, which means give me a file that I can import into Visual Studio right away, or I can stop the collection entirely. The reason you might checkpoint is maybe you are not quite sure if you got everything that you need, and you just want to keep on collecting. For me, I'll fairly ambitious here. I think I got what I need. So now that's stopping the collection. And if I go back to that log file location, so I'm collecting the file, just wait for it to be done here. It's done. And then when I open this is going to open up in Visual Studio Ultimate. One thing to keep in mind here is that, you know, you're probably going to be building an application and then you take a drop and you ship it over to operations and then you're going to keep building the next version of that application. And so when you do that, it's really important to make sure that when you're building your software using a system like Team Build that's part of Team Foundation Server, you need to make sure that you archive your symbols. And the symbols are going to be required for you to be able to identify the drop of code that's running in that production environment and then match up the hashtags back to the version of code that was running in production that you can get right out of Team Foundation Server. So we handle all that magic for you behind the scenes. You just have to make sure that you enable in the team build definition, say that you archive the symbols so that those get stored. And so here you can see all the individual threads that we're running as part of that application. If I scroll down here, you can see that for those of you that have used IntelliTrace in the past, this is new. We actually take all of your web requests now, and we can tell you which web request took the longest. We can see exactly which pages took the longest to render. If I keep scrolling down, I can see a list of all of my threads, all of my exception data. And so I can say, you know, there's a null reference exception. Let's start there. So we can say start debugging. And then this is going to open up my IntelliTrace view. And over on the right-hand side, this is a list of everything that happens sequentially within my application. So the newest events are at the very bottom, but I can scroll all the way back up to probably the start of this application and see exactly what was happening on this particular application pool. So any of my .NET code that was within scope here is going to be executed and captured and logged. And so here you can see where all my individual files are being requested. We can see here that we have some, you know, object reference is not set to an instance, so that's kind of interesting. If I keep going, I think I have some interesting exceptions here. Sometimes people look at an IntelliTrace information and they see that there's a bunch of exceptions that are firing in their code or within the low-level frameworks that they didn't even know about. So the application may be behaving just fine, but it's telling you that it doesn't have permissions to write some audit information out to a file somewhere. And maybe that's important because you work at a bank and you need to be able to audit things. And so a lot of the time, I recommend that people just run IntelliTrace collection on their existing applications, even if they're working just fine. I'm not clicking the right event here. Even if they're working just fine, because oftentimes they can find things that they didn't know were problems. And that's the event that I'm looking for here. And so here you can see this is code that's within my solution. You can see that we have a problem with the null reference exception being thrown straight from here. And then sure enough, I can see exactly what the state of all of the member variables were when this particular line of code fired. And so here I can see that this is assigned to is equal to null. And if I wanted to, I could then step back in time and debug this and understand why this got set to null. Maybe there was a file that we couldn't access to get a value from, or maybe we never initialized this value. And so this allows me to dig in and really understand exactly what's going on. Okay. The one last thing I want to talk about here is the Team Foundation service. Is anybody using the hosted Team Foundation service yet? So we've started porting Team Foundation Server over on top of the Windows Azure platform. And this is a really nice thing for folks that don't necessarily want to maintain a full Team Foundation Server that's running within, you know, under your desk or somewhere within your corporate environment. And the service is actually up and running today. We have several thousand customers that are actually using it in production for real projects, some very big companies that I've been working with for the better part of about a year now who are using the service. So that's something that's supported. If you wanted to use it, you can go to tfspreview.com and it asks you for a sign up code, but you don't need that sign up code. You can say, add me to the waiting list. We process those about once a week. So you can just put your email address in there and we'll send you back a code that you can use to sign up for the service right away. And so once you've signed up for the service, then you now have a Team Foundation Server project collection that's running in the cloud. You can start your projects. You can connect to that from either the Visual Studio 11 developer preview or beta, or you can connect to it from Visual Studio 2010. In the future, we'll have support for 2005 and 2008 as well. So if you're using those clients, they're not currently supported, but they're coming soon. And then you get all of the work item capabilities that you're used to today within the product. There are a few differences between the Team Foundation service and Team Foundation server running on premises. And those are mainly due to the level of support that exists in the Azure platform today. So for example, Azure doesn't have SQL Server reporting services yet. It's something that we expect is coming. And once that's available, then we'll be able to extend the Team Foundation service to take advantage of the reporting infrastructure. We also have a kind of a different build solution right now. Currently, what you do is you set up a build server running on-premises, and then you can use that to connect to TFS in the cloud. But certainly, it's on our backlog to, in the future, enable some sort of hosted build service so that you could say, I need 30 different build servers. Let me just scale that up, pay for what I need, and then once I'm done with maybe my crazy check-in weekend prior to a release, then you can scale that back down. So we think that this has a lot of potential. In the future, we can even do things like test lab management, certainly not in this release, but those are the types of things that we'd like to enable in the future. But today, you can get all the agile planning tools that I showed you today. You can get test case management set up, and you can really just go party on Team Foundation Service for free until we release the final version, and then we'll give you some period of time to decide if you want to migrate your data either to an on-premises server or another solution, or start paying for the service. Okay? So with that, I think we're just about at time. We have a few minutes for questions, if anybody has any questions. If I don't see you, please shout out. It's kind of hard to see in here with the lights. Yeah, thank you. So the question is whether or not you can do work item merging. And no, in this release, you can't do team work item merging. That's kind of a common request that I hear for people that are doing requirements management and baselining and that sort of thing. Is that the area you're interested in? Is that for baselining or?
We take different chain sets, put it on a work item, when it's done, we will put that work
Okay, I see. So you're moving work items around from branch to branch and changing associated change sets. That's not in the product today, but I should mention that we have a couple of mechanisms to give your feedback right to Microsoft. We have a Visual Studio user voice site, and that's been really popular. I can tell you that our product team looks at that on a weekly basis to see which requests you have, and based on those, we really do adjust our backlog and make sure that we're really delivering what you're after. I know a lot of people in 2010, for example, complained about the performance on certain systems. I don't have numbers to share today, but I know that we're doing a lot of work around performance of the development environment. And I think once you get the Visual Studio 11 beta, you're going to be pleasantly surprised. But those are the types of things that are coming from user voice. Okay. I don't see any other questions. You guys are pretty quiet here. All right. Well, thank you for coming. And again, I have a software testing talk that is going to take place tomorrow. So I look forward to seeing some of you back here. And thanks, and I hope to come back next year.